Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The Palestinian death toll hits 100 in Israel's Gaza offensive, and Germany and U.S. are to discuss the spy expulsion. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. Palestinian officials say the death toll from Israel's Gaza military offensive has risen above 100, as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he will not bow to international pressure to stop the military campaign. Mr. Netanyahu said today that no pressure would prevent Israel from combating terrorists that call for Israel's destruction. Today marked a fourth day of Israel's Gaza offensive, while Palestinian militants continued firing rockets into Israel. Gaza militants have launched about 550 rockets on Israel during the latest fighting. Officials say a rocket fired from southern Lebanon struck northern Israel near the border without causing any casualties. However, it was not immediately clear who had fired that rocket. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, meanwhile, is urging Afghans to be patient today as rival presidential candidates grapple with how extensive a review of votes should be following disputed elections.
We obviously have high hopes that the questions about the election will be resolved quickly, can be resolved, and that a way forward can take place which can give Afghans confidence that they have a presidency and a government that is capable of unifying all Afghans and building the road to the future.
Abdullah Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani both claimed victory in the June 14th runoff to replace outgoing President Hamid Karzai. Kerry arrived in Kabul overnight to mediate between the campaigns. Meanwhile, Secretary Kerry and other top administration officials concluded their visit to China Thursday for the strategic and economic dialogue. Their trip came at a key moment in U.S.-China relations. Shannon Van Zandt reports.
Top U.S. officials wrapped up 2 days of meetings in Beijing this week on a wide range of issues, but did not report any major breakthroughs. In his closing statement, Secretary Kerry said China and the U.S. found common ground on climate change, nuclear nonproliferation, North Korea, and the importance of the rule of law, among other issues. For the world's two biggest economies, finding common ground on important issues has been a struggle. U.S.-China relations were again tested this week with new media reports that Chinese hackers tried to infiltrate databases containing the personnel files of U.S. government employees. China denied the charge. Shannon Van Sant, Beijing.
Germany's foreign minister says he will discuss the expulsion of a U.S. intelligence officer from Berlin with U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry when the two diplomats see each other at meetings in Vienna in the next 2 days. Frank-Walter Steinmeier spoke to reporters Friday in Berlin, a day after Germany expelled the intelligence officer over allegations that Washington hired German operatives to sell its secret documents. Steinmeier said he will tell Kerry that Germany wants to revive its relationship with the U.S. on the basis of mutual trust. He also said Germany's decision to expel the officer was an appropriate one. The United Nations is warning governments that are ignoring the voices of young people and excluding them from important policy decisions at their peril as the world nations mark the World Population Day. Lisa Schlein reports.
Young people comprise nearly 2 billion of the more than 7 billion people who now live on this earth. Such a large number is a powerful force and cannot easily be ignored. Nevertheless, adolescents and young people are marginalized and subject to some of the worst violations and deprivations in many countries. The UN Population Fund reports an estimated 515 million adolescents and youth aged 15 to 24 live on less than $2 a day. But despite the numbers, it notes two out of three countries do not consult young people on key policy decisions that affect their lives. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Health officials say the West African Ebola outbreak has virtually stopped in Guinea, but continues to rage in neighboring Liberia and Sierra Leone. In its latest update released today, the World Health Organization says Liberia reports 11 new cases and 4 deaths from the disease, while Sierra Leone reports 32 cases and 15 deaths. The death toll from the 6-month outbreak stands at 539. On Twitter today, the WHO said current high-risk groups include mourners who touch bodies as part of burial ceremonies. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiyis Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Tens of thousands of Rwandans regularly cross the border between the towns of Gisenyi and Goma, most of them transporting produce. A number of these traders are disabled and would have difficulty finding work other than peddling carts across the frontier.
That's VOA's Nick Long reporting from the border town of Gisenyi in Rwanda. Details coming up.
Also in the news, the Human Rights Watch has condemned a recent Ugandan court ruling against lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender activists. And the West African Ebola outbreak has virtually stopped in Guinea, but continues to rage in neighboring Liberia and Sierra Leone.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Rwanda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the DRC has dropped a plan to impose visa fees on cross-border traders from Rwanda. As Nick Long reports from the border town of Gisenyi, the move could be a sign that tensions are easing between the two countries.
Relations between the DRC and Rwanda took a turn for the worse on June the 11th when Congolese and Rwandan troops clashed at the border near Goma. After several hours of firefights, the dead bodies of five Congolese soldiers were found by the Red Cross just inside Rwanda. There had been hardly any open hostilities between Rwandan and DRC forces for several years before this incident. Although calm was quickly restored, trade between the two countries appeared to be threatened when a couple of weeks later, the DRC Immigration Service in Goma announced it would begin imposing visa fees on all Rwandans doing business in Congo and on students who commute there. Tens of thousands of Rwandans regularly cross the border between the towns of Gisenyi and Goma, most of them transporting produce. A number of these traders are disabled and would have difficulty finding work other than peddling carts across the frontier. Jean-Baptiste Nyamulinda is one of these disabled traders. Speaking to VOA before the visa plan had been dropped, he said he had been told he would have to pay $50 for a three-month visa. He had not heard that disabled people would be exempt and was hoping God would help them. Several other traders told VOA they would not be able to afford visas, which they had been told would be $50 for 3 months for informal traders, $30 a year for students, and $250 a year for salaried people living and working in Goma. However, the threat of trade visas now appears to have been lifted after some outside intervention. A regional body, the Economic Community of Great Lakes Countries, wrote to DRC authorities asking for clarification and pointing out that the visa plan was in breach of a regional agreement on free movement of goods and people. Economic Community official Joseph Letitio told VOA Thursday that the DRC's foreign ministry has clarified its position.
Alors nous avons reçu une réponse du gouvernement de la République démocratique du Congo.
He says the DRC's response was to point out that other member states, namely Rwanda and Burundi, require Congolese citizens living in their countries to pay for a long-stay visa, which is why the DRC has decided to apply the same measure. Officials in Goma said this week that this fee does not apply to cross-border traders who visit Congo on a daily basis. Letitio says the parties will come together to sort out concerns.
Alors, le gouvernement propose également que une réunion se tienne.
He says the DRC government has asked the community to organize a meeting of officials from the three countries to clear up any misunderstandings about the DRC's visa plans. This is only one of the border disputes between the DRC and Rwanda, and by no means the most serious, but its successful resolution could signal a thaw in their relations overall. Goma-based analyst Timo Müller, who works for the US-based NGO The Enough Project, says DRC-Rwanda relations reached a dangerously low point with the cross-border fighting in June.
This military escalation also did lead to a diplomatic quarrel between the two countries, with Rwanda threatening to withdraw from an earlier peace agreement, a regional peace agreement signed in February 2013. Luckily, it hasn't done so, but I think we should take this threat seriously.
The biggest bilateral issue is that Kigali insists that so long as the Rwandan rebel group in eastern Congo, the FDLR, is not disarmed, it poses a direct threat to Rwanda. A UN group of experts on the Congo reported last week that about 200 of the estimated 1,500 FDLR fighters have been demobilized since the start of this year. The DRC government said it was giving the FDLR another 6 months to lay down their arms. The concern is that the demobilization will stall. Resource-rich eastern Congo has long been prone to conflict, attracting regional and ethnic militias for years. UN forces have been active in routing out these groups during the last year in an effort to bring some stability to the region. Nick Long for VOA News, Gisenyi.
Human Rights Watch has condemned a recent Ugandan court ruling against lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender activists whose workshop on rights advocacy was broken up 2 years ago by the government. As Hilary Hewler reports from Kampala, HRW says the ruling is part of a pattern of intimidation of activists.
In February 2012, Uganda's Minister for Ethics and Integrity, Simon Lokoto, stormed into a human rights workshop run by gay and lesbian activists in Entebbe and shut it down. The organizers sued Lokoto, arguing that the workshop was intended to develop advocacy and leadership skills. But on Wednesday, Uganda's High Court ruled against the activists, saying Lokoto had acted in the public interest by protecting Ugandan moral standards. Nila Ghoshal of Human Rights Watch says the decision could have worrying implications for public health in Uganda and strikes a serious blow against freedom of speech.
It essentially shuts down freedom of expression and freedom of assembly for LGBT people, and it also calls into question whether perhaps even distributing condoms to LGBT people could be considered illegal. The judge has made quite a stretch and essentially drawn the conclusion that even talking about LGBT rights is a criminal activity and that the government has a right to shut that down.
Uganda's Anti-Homosexuality Act, which formally outlaws promotion of homosexuality, was signed into law in February. Earlier this week, the Ugandan government issued a statement saying that Western governments had misunderstood the act and that it was not intended to persecute gay people or prevent civil society groups from doing their work. Ghoshal says the official position on gay rights in Uganda seems to be contradictory.
On the one hand, you have the government putting out this statement, probably in reaction to decisions by the U.S. and by other donors to revoke some funding to Uganda. But at the same time, the courts are essentially sending the opposite message that any speech about gay rights is illegal. We have people who have been arrested, people who've been evicted from their homes, people who have been turned away from healthcare on the basis of the Anti-Homosexuality Act.
Despite widespread international condemnation, the Anti-Homosexuality Act is popular with Ugandan citizens. The judge's decision, says Ghoshal, may be based on a political agenda. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Kampala.
Thirteen minutes past the hour. This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. The South African government denied parole to Eugene de Kock, a police colonel who led so-called death squads in the apartheid government's anti-insurgency forces in the 1980s and 90s. De Kock has served 20 years in a Pretoria prison. Minister of Justice Michael Masuta denied the request for parole late yesterday. De Kock is called prime evil in local media, and his parole request has stirred controversy in South Africa. Masuta said the parole was not granted because families of his victims had not been consulted. The minister added that he would reconsider de Kock's application within the next 12 months. As head of a counterinsurgency unit at a farm called Blokplaas during white rule, de Kock is believed responsible for more atrocities than any other security official. He confessed responsibility for many killings during the 1999 Truth and Reconciliation Commission hearings. De Kock was arrested in 1994, the year Nelson Mandela became president. He was sentenced in 1996 to 212 years in prison on 89 charges ranging from murder and attempted murder to kidnapping and fraud.
The United Nations support mission in Libya, UNSMIL, is temporarily reducing its staff due to security concerns. UNSMIL spokesman Samir Gattas said they made the decision to remove dozens of employees after a month-long study of the security situation on the ground. He said the reduction was not linked to any specific threat. UNSMIL was created by the UN Security Council in 2011 to help Libya's transitional authorities after longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi was ousted and killed. Its mission includes helping to ensure a democratic transition, control unsecured arms, and protect human rights.
The abduction of more than 200 young girls from a school in northern Nigeria by the militant group Boko Haram has been big news in recent months. But human rights advocates note this type of violence against women and young girls is nothing new. Kidnapping is one of the many forms of violence regularly practiced against women and young girls in developing countries. Such abuses include rape, sex trafficking, child marriage, and child prostitution. Michelle Rickett is founder and CEO of She Is Safe, an organization that rescues and rehabilitates women and girls who are victims of abuse. She is also the author of Forgotten Girls, a just-released book that chronicles the lives of the victims. Rickett lived in and traveled to high-risk areas of the globe and knows firsthand the plight of the women and girls. She spoke with me about the urgency of breaking the cycle of violence. Well, we will come back with that story a little bit later. Meanwhile, aid workers in Nigeria say they have never been closer to eradicating polio, with only 4 new cases reported this year. But as insurgent attacks grow more violent in the north, the workers say vaccination programs are at high risk, and continued success will depend on new strategies to reach children in what have become war zones. Heather Murdoch has more from Abuja.
Globally, polio this year has increased by more than 15%, with 10 countries reporting new cases. 2 years ago, there were only 4 countries that had polio, which can kill or cripple, and there is no cure. The World Health Organization calls the spread a public health emergency. But in Nigeria, the number of new cases this year has decreased by 85% to 4 cases reported so far this year, compared to 26 cases reported in the same time frame in 2013. Kazim Mustafa is the vice chairman of Rotary International's Nigeria National Polio Plus Committee.
We have never gotten this close to eradicating polio, because if you look at the statistics, compared to last year, we've really done very, very good.
But northern Nigeria, where most of the polio cases are found, is getting more dangerous, and Boko Haram insurgents have killed thousands of people this year alone. Militants have been holding more than 200 schoolgirls captive for nearly 3 months, and hundreds of other children have been slaughtered in their schoolhouses. Mustafa says despite more than a year of emergency rule in 3 northern states, the insurgency remains the biggest threat to meeting eradication goals.
When our field coordinators are even going for a particular assignment, and they get information that an area is, at that particular time, not very safe, what do? They retreat.
He says vaccination teams are still operating amid the violence and trying new strategies, like going into dangerous areas in a matter of days or hours, calling it a hit and run. Firewalling an area, says Mustafa, means setting up vaccination points around war zones, so when the people flee their homes, children can be vaccinated. But Boko Haram attacks continue with increasing sophistication and reach. Mustafa says vaccination efforts need to do the same.
There is need for more collaboration and gathering of intelligence, even partnership, you know, with security agencies to advise on when to move in and move out. But honestly speaking, it is a problem.
But Mustafa says he is still confident that Nigeria can start the clock on declaring the country polio-free by the end of 2014. Nigeria's last reported case was in May, and it takes 3 years without new cases to be declared polio-free. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
19 minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, as we mentioned earlier, the abduction of more than 200 young girls from a school in northern Nigeria by the militant group Boko Haram has been big news in recent months. But human rights advocates note this type of violence against women and young girls is nothing new. Kidnapping is one of the many forms of violence regularly practiced against women and young girls in developing countries. Michelle Rickett is founder and CEO of She Is Safe, an organization that rescues and rehabilitates women and girls who are victims of abuse. She spoke with me about the urgency of breaking the cycle of violence.
This is a problem. The abduction of girls, use, misuse, abuse, selling of girls is a fairly wide practice, and it's only exacerbated under conflict or, as in the case of the Boko Haram, they're sort of combining purposes. Often when soldiers of any kind or terrorists of any kind roll through a village, they will torch the village, take the boys and train them to kill, but take the girls and use them to do their cooking and cleaning and for sex as well. So that's a pretty common practice wherever you see conflict in the world. Unfortunately, it's such a common practice that it's almost conflict as usual. However, in this case, we have the wonderful advantage of the mothers of the abducted more than 200 girls, that original group of girls. They were not willing to lay silent. It was more than 2 weeks after the girls were abducted that the government really began to respond to the needs, and it was because the mothers were rallying and gathering others. So I think that gives us a little clue how to keep the issues alive, even though it might be in a war or conflict as usual and the abuse of girls. Still, there are those who are passionate about making a difference for them and raising a public outcry. And the more that we join them, the more we'll begin to see these practices brought into the light.
So this is occurring around the world, and there are some high-risk areas. What are some of the high-risk areas where these kidnappings, abductions, and violence against young girls are occurring?
Throughout most of the developing world, and this was certainly my awakening to the issues for girls around the world, my husband and I in the middle 80s lived in East Africa. We lived in Nairobi for his work and really loved our friends and neighbors. But I began to be very disturbed when I learned that many of the neighbor girls around us were kept out of school to work, marry, or be sold.
So you pretty much touched on then my next question. I was going to ask you what happens to them when they are kidnapped, but for the most part they are put to use as wives or slavery?
Or raped, especially in a conflict situation. It's almost like you lift a lid on normal behavior and aggression kind of overflows. And girls are not only kept as wives, but they're raped multiple times a day and people use objects on them. It's a much more fierce kind of abuse. Just the everyday abduction of girls for marriage is still fairly widely practiced throughout North Africa, the Middle East, and throughout Asia.
This has to be a very horrific experience for them. Not only are they subjected to physical abuse, but there has to be a mental and emotional abuse going on at the same time. So how are they able to go on with life after having suffered these types of abuses?
Of course, the human spirit is tremendously resilient, but the post-traumatic stress on these girls really does call for a concerted effort for aftercare to get them into a safe and predictable location where they can receive physical nourishment, emotional nourishment, and for their broken spirits to be healed as well. And then some sort of therapeutic and vocational direction and training so that they can begin to imagine a new life forward.
That was Michelle Rickett, founder and CEO of She Is Safe. She is also the author of the just-released book, Forgotten Girls. She spoke with me from Atlanta, Georgia.
The
The United Nations warns that governments are ignoring the voices of young people and excluding them from important policy decisions at their peril. As the nations mark World Population Day today, the UN Population Fund says investing in the well-being of adolescents and young people benefits communities throughout the world. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Young people comprise nearly 2 billion of the more than 7 billion people who now live on this earth. Such a large number is a powerful force and cannot easily be ignored. Nevertheless, adolescents and young people are marginalized and subject to some of the worst violations and deprivations in many countries. The UN Population Fund reports an estimated 515 million adolescents and youth aged 15 to 24 live on less than $2 a day. But despite the numbers, it notes two out of three countries do not consult young people on key policy decisions that affect their lives. The agency says young people face many challenges, especially in poor developing countries in Africa and Asia, where their numbers are huge. Obstetrician and senior advisor for maternal health at UNFPA, Luc de Bernis, says millions of young people who enter puberty are faced with physical changes and become vulnerable to human rights abuses as well.
This is particularly important where the youth and adolescents, particularly girls, are facing high risks. Risk of coerced sex, and we know that 10% of the young girls would started the intercourse experiences before 16. It's due to coerced sex, and this is leading to complication, to early pregnancy, to abortions.
Globally, UN statistics find more than 15 million girls aged 15 to 19 give birth every year. The UN says early marriages, early pregnancies, and births account for the high percentage of maternal deaths in developing countries. In addition, studies show more than 2 million adolescents between the ages of 10 and 19 are living with HIV, a disease linked to coerced sex in such cases. Dr. De Bernis tells VOA it is tragic that young girls are forced to face so many unacceptable risks.
It took me years working in developing countries to understand, to realize that when you are a small girl, a young girl, you have no any place where you can be safe. You cannot be safe very often in the family, unfortunately. You cannot be safe in the street. You cannot be safe at school when girls are not respected, when there is no toilet, where there is no space, and where the violence is.
Dr. De Bernis says healthy, educated, productive young people can help break the cycle of intergenerational poverty and can contribute to their communities and nations. He says UNFPA is working with governments and with civil society to promote comprehensive sexuality education as well as quality sexual and reproductive health services. He says the agency is working with traditional leaders to try to change their perception of young people and to get their support in banning early marriage and improving young lives. He thinks the old adage that children should be seen and not heard is twisted. On the contrary, he says, governments would do well to listen to the voices of young people, to respect them, and to realize how all can benefit from the contributions youth can make to their country's development. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehei Yiswuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Put your flags up in the sky, in the sky.
Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit VOAfootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet and will bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at VOAfootball.com.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Human Rights Watch condemns a recent Ugandan court ruling against lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender activists. The West African Ebola outbreak has virtually stopped in Guinea, but continues to rage in neighboring Liberia and Sierra Leone. Coming up, we'll have music from Rwanda, and in our feature segment, we focus on Zimbabwean immigrants in the United States. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next.
Put your flags up in the sky. In the sky. And the sky. The sky. Show the world where you're from. Show where you're from.
Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy Friday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have a preview of Sunday's World Cup football final.
Kim, Germany will play Argentina in Sunday's World Cup football final in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Germany is bidding for its fourth world title, while Argentina is aiming for its third. And speaking of three, this marks the third time the teams have met in the World Cup final. In the 1986 World Cup final played in Mexico City, Argentina defeated the then West Germany 3-2. With the score tied at 2-2 and about 6 minutes left, Argentine superstar Diego Maradona threaded a brilliant, delicate pass that Jorge Burucaga converted for the winning goal. And 4 years later at the 1990 World Cup final in Rome, the Germans gained revenge, winning 1-0 on a penalty shot by Andreas Brehm with about 5 minutes left in the match. As we look forward to Sunday's big game in Rio, the Germans are well aware that scoring 7 goals like they did against host Brazil in the semifinals is unlikely. The Germans were able to capitalize on gaping holes in the Brazilian defense. But Germany's assistant coach, Hansi Flick, says Argentina will be a completely different opponent. He says Argentina features a very compact defense and, of course, has an extraordinary player in Lionel Messi. Messi is hoping to solidify his greatness by lifting the World Cup trophy for the first time. Meanwhile, Brazilian star Neymar, who did not play in the semifinal against Germany because of a fractured vertebra, says he'll be supporting Argentina in Sunday's final. Neymar says he wants Barcelona teammates Messi and Javier Mascherano to win football's biggest prize. Neymar singled out Messi for special praise and said the World Cup would be a fitting addition to his bulging trophy cabinet. In Neymar's words, and I quote, "I think he deserves to be champion. I am cheering for him because he is a friend and a teammate, and I wish him a lot of luck." Meanwhile, Brazil will host the Netherlands on Saturday in the capital, Brasilia, in the World Cup's third-place match. The old sports emperor Barry Mon enjoys describing this game as the Kiss Your Sister match.
Hey, g'day, mates. Remember me? This is the old sports emperor with a red-hot listening tip. That's right. Give a listen to my pal, the bright and lively Sunny Man on the Sunny Side of Sports, right here on the Voice of America.
Put
Put your flags up in the sky.
Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit VOAfootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet and will bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at VOAfootball.com.
I mentioned Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. And my Twitter handle is at VOA Sunny Sports. I tweeted earlier Friday that it's good to be back in the ball game after being sidelined Thursday by illness. And here's a Sunny Side of Sports shout out for the mighty Douglas Mpuga, who provided sporty relief for me on Thursday. Algeria and Nigeria were the top performing African teams at the World Cup in Brazil. Both the Desert Foxes of Algeria and the Super Eagles of Nigeria reached the round of 16, marking the first time two African teams have advanced to the knockout stages at the same World Cup. Following Nigeria's elimination by France, Nigeria's sports ministry gave the boot to top Nigeria Football Federation officials, a move that did not sit well with FIFA, World Football's governing body. On Wednesday, FIFA suspended Nigeria from all international competition and has given the ministry until next Tuesday, July 15th, to reinstate the NFF officials who were sacked. There's been mixed reaction in Lagos to FIFA suspending Nigeria for government interference. First, we hear from Super Eagles fan Tunlope Ogunwobi.
Even FIFA also mixes football with politics themselves. So, I mean, the government of a nation should move the nation forward. And if the government of the nation feels that the football house is having issues, and really, Nigerian Football Federation is really, there's so much politics in it. They're always quarreling with the coaches, complaining about some players not being there. So the government should sanitize issues.
And next up, we hear from Emeka Nwani, a football commentator in Nigeria.
The NFF, they have budgetary allocations. The NFF is captured in the budget of every government in this country. So that interference must be there as long as they are bringing out that money. And that is my quarrel with FIFA. FIFA will not tell Nigerians that they don't know that the government funds football in this country and that the government funds NFF. I am not saying that interference is good. I know what FIFA, you know, means by not interfering, so that if any federation wants to do what they want to do, they will do it without thinking of, oh, this person is related to this governor, this person is related to this person in the presidency. But it cannot be possible in Nigeria when that same federation gets money from the government. I am just saying that if I'm in government and this type of thing happens, I will just say, NFF, we are not fighting. We are not quarreling. If there is war in this country, nobody will talk about football. So the government must make that enabling environment ready.
That's Emeka Nwani, a football commentator in Lagos, reacting to FIFA's suspension of Nigeria. Joining us once again from Johannesburg with our latest African football quiz question, World Cup related, is David Legg.
Who was the most successful coach of an African team at all the World Cups? Now, I stress an African team. So in other words, it can be a foreign coach or it can be an African coach. Now, what's very important is how you decide who has been the most successful. And what you do, Sonny, is you base it on percentage success. And what you do is you look at the record of each coach. Now, for example, I'm going to pick out one coach, Vidinic. He coached Morocco in 1970, and he coached what was then called Zaire in 1974. So he coached at two consecutive World Cups with different countries. Now, his record, Sonny, and he's obviously not the winner, that's why I can mention him, is 6 matches played, 1 draw and 5 defeats. And unfortunately, the reason he saw his team score only 2 goals but concede 20 is, of course, Zaire were hammered 9-0 at the 1974 World Cup by the then Yugoslavia. So in other words, Sonny, he's played 6 matches now. In each match, you've got 3 points available for a win. So that's a total of 18 points. And he got 1 draw, so he only got 1 point. So what you do is you get that 1, the 1 point, you divide it by 18, which is the potential total, and then you multiply by 100. And that's how you work out your percentage success. Because, Sonny, it's the only fair way to do it, because like you take a coach like Henri Michel of France. He's coached at 9 matches at the World Cup, and then other coaches have only coached at, say, 3. So I think this is a very fair system. So what we want to know is who has been the most successful coach of an African team at the World Cups, and that's going, Sonny, from 1934 to 2010. And I'm sure you're going to have a very good prize or prizes for the winners, because they're going to sweat a bit on this one, Sonny.
Yes, David, we will have some of those delightful VOA goodies for the winners. Why don't we set a deadline, David, of July 13th, which is when the World Cup final will be played in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. David and I will now give our addresses where you can send your entries. And once again, we have a July 13th deadline for our latest African football quiz question. VOA!
It's david.leg, and leg is spelled L-E-G-G-E, at AFP, that's Agence France-Presse.com. So I'll just repeat that one more time. It's david.leg, L-E-G-G-E, at AFP.com.
You can send me email at sonny@voanews.com. Sonny is spelled S-O-N-N-Y. And pick up a pen or a pencil and a piece of paper. My full postal mailing address is The Sunny Side of Sports, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, room 1613, Washington, D.C., 20237. Voice of America, VOA,
Washington. This is the Voice of America, Washington. D.C.
Big basketball story on Friday. LeBron James, the most valuable player for the Miami Heat, says he's returning to the Cleveland Cavaliers. LeBron, the biggest name on the free agent market in the NBA. In an exclusive story with Sports Illustrated magazine, LeBron has, he says, I'm coming home. I'm coming home to the Cleveland Cavaliers. And LeBron writes, and I quote, before anyone ever cared where I would play basketball, I was a kid from Northeast Ohio. It's where I walked. It's where I ran. It's where I cried. It's where I bled. It holds a special place in my heart. The Cleveland Cavaliers certainly have a special place in their heart because right now they have LeBron James back in their lineup, the four-time NBA Most Valuable Player, leaving the Miami Heat and returning to the Cleveland Cavaliers. Finally, here's a Sunny Side of Sports salute to Novak Djokovic, who continued what's being described as the greatest week of his life by marrying his longtime girlfriend, Jelena Ristich, at a seaside resort on the Adriatic Sea. Djokovic married Ristich, who was pregnant with their first child, 4 days after winning his second Wimbledon singles title and 3 days after reclaiming the world number one ranking. After defeating Swiss rival Roger Federer at Wimbledon in a classic 5-set final, Djokovic said he was dedicating the win to his new wife and their future baby. Congratulations, Novak Djokovic. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Okay, thank you, Sonny. And listen to The Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And today, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of The Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
In our feature segment, Zimbabwean immigrants living in the United States. And next, the first African fashion TV in Senegal. But first, some music. Here is Christopher from Rwanda with Owu Monsi. Rwanda's Christopher with Uwo Monsi.
Well, thousands of children who migrate to various countries with their parents find it difficult to adjust to new environments after leaving Zimbabwe. Some parents say their children find it difficult to learn a new language and adjust to different education systems, among other issues. There are more than 40,000 Zimbabwean immigrants living in the United States alone. That includes those who fled persecution under President Robert Mugabe's ZANU-PF party, which has been in power since independence from British rule in 1980. VOA's Gibbs Dube speaks to Dumafi Mema, president of the Association of Zimbabweans Based Abroad.
They are young and they can quickly adjust to the American culture. But what happens is they grow up, they spend most of their time at school being assimilated into the American culture. When they come home, the parents want to treat them or teach them the Zimbabwean culture. So they get conflicted as to which culture they should actually learn. Because the parents keep pushing that you are Zimbabwean, you don't belong here, you need to preserve your culture, you need to know your culture. But most of the time they spend it with Americans, not with their parents at school or at play. So in the end, some of the children kind of get confused. They begin to act out in terms of behavior. They get into drugs, they get into behavior that is not acceptable legally, and they get into trouble with the law.
And as a parent, how do you actually handle such situations?
Each area in this country, we have Zimbabwean groups, social groups. We, as Zimbabweans, whenever we meet, whenever we are staying close to each other, we have these social groups where we meet once in a while to celebrate birthdays, to celebrate whatever situation that we need to celebrate. And so I would take my children to mingle with Zimbabweans so they can learn our languages, whether it's in Ndebele, whether it's Shona. They can see how we as Zimbabweans alone kind of interact with one another. What is acceptable behavior amongst ourselves as Zimbabweans? And then when we get home, I try to kind of have an open discussion with them to see where they're having issues or where they're having trouble to adjust, whether to as an American or as a Zimbabwean. So that open discussion, they have questions as to their identity. There's questions as to whether we ever going to go back to Zimbabwe and so forth. So it opens up for me to know what they're thinking, what is conflicting them in their minds, and how to help them to settle well.
So the other issue is on language. In most cases, they have to adjust to the American system, you know. So now, how do they adjust in terms of language? Is it difficult?
It depends on the parents. Some parents are very strict. Whilst they appreciate their children learning the American language, English language, they also expect their children to speak their native language, which is either Shona or Ndebele. So with such parents, I've seen kids who can speak both Shona and Ndebele plus English. And then there are the parents who really don't care. They just want their children to speak English, even at home. The language of communication is English. So they never know Ndebele or they never know Shona. They can know a little bit, just to greet. And that's it. So it depends on the parent, the parenting style.
That was Dumafi Mema, president of the Association of Zimbabweans Based Abroad, speaking to Studio 7 from the state of Indiana.
Annual Dakar Fashion Week got underway with the launch of African Fashion TV, the first TV channel in Senegal to focus on the latest African couture. VOA's Carolyn Turner reports from Dakar.
The designers dazzled at Dakar's annual Fashion Week. Now in its 12th year, the event featured more than 19 designers from Africa, as well as the U.S. and Holland. Shows were staged at venues around the capital in a bid to make high fashion accessible to ordinary Senegalese. Models sashayed down the catwalk wearing bold and modern cuts, looks you'll likely see again later this year in stores and style magazines. Fashion Week is the brainchild of stylist Adama Ndiaye, also known as Adama Paris. She says the industry is becoming a contributor towards Senegal's economic growth.
There are many things that have changed, especially when it comes to designer participation. There are more and more designers coming from all over the world, from Europe to Asia, and that's a very good thing.
celebrated U.S.-based designer Moussa Dia, also known as Versailles, who counts Mary Blige and Beyoncé amongst his clients, says there's no reason why African designers should not be in the same league as their counterparts in New York, London, or Milan.
This is the first time I come to Africa to do a show. I did a few shows in the United States, and I really love it over here. People are very friendly. They're very into the show. So I feel it's much better here than the States or anywhere else where they're a little more cool. This, over here, people are very friendly. They're happy. They're into the show, and I enjoy being around here. And this is my hometown, so I love being here.
This year's event marks the official launch of Africa Fashion TV, a channel dedicated to showcasing African designers.
The content, like the name indicates, will be 100% African fashion and not just in Africa. It will also include the influence of African fashion on the diaspora and the world. We will go to New York and Paris, going through Tokyo with a focus on showcasing black models, African fashion, and not just ready-to-wear, but also African couture.
Organizers are hoping the channel will encourage a larger demand for African designs. Carolyn Turner, VOA News.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The celebrations were muted July 9th as South Sudan celebrated its third anniversary of independence. 3 years ago, after decades of civil war, the South Sudanese people voted to split away from the North. And, amid high hopes and much jubilation, the world's newest nation was born on July 9th, 2011. The cheer has turned to gloom in many parts of the East African nation as political infighting erupted in December. The conflict, now in its seventh month, has cost thousands of lives and displaced over 1 million people. Despite repeated attempts to bring the parties to the bargaining table to negotiate a transitional government and end the crisis, foot-dragging by both the government of South Sudan and the rebel faction headed by former Vice President Riek Machar continue to undermine the process led by the Regional Bloc Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD. Too much blood has been spilled and too many lives lost to allow South Sudan's moment of hope and opportunity to slip from its grasp. With the memories of July 9th, 2011 fresh in mind, now is the time to honor fully the cessation of hostilities agreement of January 23rd to end the violence, especially which targets civilians. The people of South Sudan need their leaders to use the IGAD peace process to end the conflict and establish a transitional government that can ensure stability, prosperity, and peace for all. Now is the time for the nation's leaders to show courage and leadership and to reaffirm their commitment to unity, to reconciliation and accountability, and to a better future for the people of South Sudan. The United States, which has stood with the people of South Sudan throughout its troubled path to independence, remains committed to continue supporting them during its current crisis, as well as to lead the international response to the looming humanitarian and refugee crisis there. We remain a steadfast partner in support of their efforts to achieve a more peaceful and prosperous future for their young nation.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.